Blog Talk Radio.
Buckle up and get ready to ride this cosmic wave of knowledge. Talk Radio. It's time to reach beyond the limitations of your mind. A time to travel where the impossible is now possible. As we travel around the world in search of the truth. And now, author, international clairvoyant, and Earth Mysteries investigator, Betsy Lewis.
Betsy Lewis.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Stargate Radio. I am so excited to be here again and hope you're all staying cool with this huge heat wave we're having. Tonight, award-winning author Ron Felber joins us to discuss his best-selling book, Mojave Incidents. And it's a crazy book. I mean, it's bone-chilling. It's scary what this couple went through in the Mojave Desert in 1989. So let me tell you a little bit about Ron. Ron is an author of both fiction and nonfiction books, including television and film documentaries. There's El Dottore, I think I'm mispronouncing that, The Double Life of a Mafia Doctor, which became a Fox primetime series, The Mob Doctor, and then his Mojave Incident became a one-hour documentary on Sci-Fi Channel. His novels include The Radiant and the Jack Madsen series, A Man of Indeterminate Value, The Kafka Society, and Dark Angel. Ron began his writing career as a deputy sheriff, which is really interesting. And that's why he's written so many true detective magazines and novels. And he went on to pen novels for the iconic Nick Carter series. Be sure and check out Ron's website at ronfelber, that's F-E-L-B-E-R.com. So let me bring him on. Ron, are you there?
Yes, I am, Betsy. I'm so happy that you actually pronounced Man of Indeterminate Value correctly. You have no idea how people pronounce that.
Oh.
No one gets
it
right. I think you're the first.
No. Really? Well, I'm surprised I got it.
It's not a real common word, right? Yeah. Indeterminate.
No, it's not.
But you did it.
Did I get the Italian right? I don't think so.
No, pretty close. Il Dottore. Il Dottore,
okay.
The doctor.
It'll work.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'll work. Close enough for jazz.
You know, it's really serendipitous how we connected. And I found your original pocketbook, Searchers, at a yard sale in Sun Valley, Idaho, years ago. And I just left the book on a shelf, and it fell off a shelf one day. And I decided, well, I better read this book. I've had this book for a long time. And I picked it up. I read it. I was blown away. Just blown away. So I contacted you in 2014. I think it was 2014 the first time. And we did an interview on my previous talk show. And the rest is history. And then you republished the book in 2015 as Mojave Incident.
Yeah.
So tell us, how did you get involved with, you know, a story, a true story about a couple that was abducted or held hostage, I guess you'd say, hours in the desert?
It was 18 hours, that kind of, you know, pushing 2 days, pushing the other side of 2 days, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
A long time. And that's really what makes it so unique. You know, there's a lot of things where people catch glimpses of something or people have an experience. But this is a prolonged experience and an exposure to almost to a different reality. So it's like the curtain is drawn and you see this massive other alternate reality right in front of you and you're living it. And that's so different from, again, seeing something in the sky or you know, having an encounter of some kind. It was a full-blown experience. Actually, when I first heard about it, a mutual friend of myself and the Giffords, a fellow that worked for me as a salesperson, And he said, you know, I have this story. I know you're a writer. I have this story that I think you'd really love. The people are very reluctant to come forward. And I said, you know, I'm doing detective stories, and I'm doing, you know, sort of true life fiction. And true life stories are nonfiction. And I don't really do things about, you know, UFOs and that kind of thing. He said, no. This is something really special. Just come to California and meet these people. So truly, reluctantly, I said, well, you know, look, this is a friend of mine. If he's so insistent, I'll go. I'll see what happens here. But when I met the Giffords, I was so impressed with their credibility, with their how stable they were, how grounded they were, their mm-hmm. backgrounds. You know, this is like, you know, two people that if you were a lawyer, you would want as witnesses in your case. You know, just very staid and very reliable in their their testimony, their explanation of the story.
They're a Mormon couple, right?
Yes. Actually, they were not so religious, but after this experience, you know, I think it really had dramatic effects, you know, on their life, as you would imagine it would. And I think they turned to religion, Mormon religion, for comfort.
Well, tell us, set up the scenario of what happened. Why were they out in the Mojave Desert? It was October, right, of 1989.
Yeah, October 21st.
Okay. And Tom's a hunter, right? So it was a camping trip on a weekend, and he was going to go hunting. And Elise, I guess, wasn't happy about it, right?
Right. Exactly. So basically, they had a couple of children at the time. They had a 2.5-year-old, Thomas, and they had Zoe, who was like 6 months old. So maybe if you've had young children or been a mother of young children, you would feel you just need to get out. You need to get away from the kids and away from housework and whatnot. So she was feeling that way. And Tom, who was a supervisor of large construction projects, you know, had a certain amount of stress to his job as well. So she wanted to go out and, you know, party, you know, have some dinner, have some drinks, do some dancing, listen to some music. And he had something else in mind, which was going on a hunting trip. So these two things don't fit together very well. But what they agreed to was that they would go on their way to the Mojave Desert, where he would do his hunting. On the way, they would stop at a place called Whiskey Pete's, and they would have where they had music and good food. And they'd stop there and have a really nice night out. And then they would travel to the Mojave Desert, into the Mojave Desert, which wasn't too far from Whiskey Pete's. And he would do his hunting, you know, and they'd camp out for a couple of nights. So that was the sort of compromise each of them made. But what they couldn't begin to imagine is what happened next. And it's just shocking, you know, shocking in its scope.
Well, it really is shocking what happened. Now, go back a little bit, because I think Tom had some strange encounters as a child, and I'm not sure if Elise did. Did she also? Some strange things
no,
that happened?
But, you know, it's no. Interesting you mentioned that, because maybe I'll get into the story a little bit. They had gone to Whiskey Pete's, and they intended to stay at a hotel, a motel there, and or a campsite. But mm-hmm. the campsite was full, Mid-Hill campsite. So they wound up going into the desert. Now, both of them had their experiences that affected the way they looked at this. Elise had had a sexual assault, which really played heavy. So for her to go into the desert where she'd read about motorcycle gangs exchanging drugs and violence and murder, you know, that could happen in these desolate places, she wasn't happy to go in there at night. And Tom, on the other hand, when he was a young boy, and this was buried deep in his subconscious, had had a UFO experience. As a young boy, he was fishing while his parents were camping with another couple. So they went fishing, and the two boys saw this orb in the sky. And, you know, they were puzzled by what it was. But the more they looked at it, the closer it came, until they found that this thing was coming towards them and over them. So they ran, and they dropped their fishing poles and just ran to the campsite where their parents were, told them, you know, there's this flying saucer that we saw. Now, of course, if you're hearing about a flying saucer from, you know, 2 9-year-old kids, you probably say, oh, that's fine. I'm glad to hear it. You know, and you wouldn't take it very seriously. But he took it very seriously, and it was buried in deep in his subconscious. So actually, when they went into the desert that evening, they made a campfire, and they cooked up a couple of steaks. They had a camper, made a fire. And after they've eaten, they were sort of throwing breadcrumbs and whatnot to the they have these sort of kangaroo rats that are there, sort of like squirrels. And the squirrels would eat the marshmallows or eat the bread, and, you know, it was just sort of amusing. And then they started stargazing. And Tom, you know, was familiar with that kind of thing. He, you know, he was at least familiar with the stars and configurations. And so basically they're stargazing, and he's pointing out the different configurations, Pegasus, you know, Algol, whatever, those kinds of things. And he says, well, that's a double star. So then his wife responds, well, if that's a double star, that must be a triple star, because it's much bigger and brighter than the double star. So Tom is kind of puzzled, and they're both kind of puzzled. But they keep staring at this. And actually, around that time, behind a mountain, so it's mountainous, there's Wall Mountain, there's Tabletop Mountain, and so it's mountainous. Mm-hmm. So Tom looks over his shoulder, and he sees a UFO, literally like there, 30 foot in diameter and soundless. The last thing he wants to do is say that to Elise, who's already a little nervous. So he ignores it and actually plays like a kind of peekaboo where the object goes behind the mountain and then comes out again. And so he turns away, and obviously a chill goes down his spine, because he remembers what happened when he was a young kid. So now they're stargazing, and of course this is in the back of his mind that he just saw a UFO, and they're trying to explain, well, what could that be? And they say, well, maybe it's some kind of balloon, or maybe it's some kind of experimental craft, because clearly it's larger and brighter than any star. And next thing they know, there are 9 of them. There are 9 bright objects. And they form a configuration of an M over Wood Mountain. So if you can imagine a large M formed by 9 UFOs, that's what they're looking at.
Wow. Ron, before you go any further, tell them why they were going to go to a campground, but they couldn't stay there. Tell them why they went on.
Well, the campsite was full, and they couldn't get in it because it was sold out, which was really
unusual
for that time of year. So, you know, you could very much look at it like this was sort of predestined in some strange way to get them there. You know, some larger forces than we would know about made the Mid-Hills campsite sold out, so they had to go into the desert at night as they did.
Why did they go so far, though? Didn't they go into, like, a canyon, though? Wasn't that...
It's sort of like a bowl.
Okay.
Sort of like a bowl. And the reason they were there is that because that's where Tom had been hunting the season before, his dad and brother. And the reason he was so anxious to get back was because he missed the shot at a mule deer, which was a prize trophy. And his brother and father gave him a relentless hard time about missing the shot. So he wanted to go back the next season, which was now, you know, to make things right.
Wow, that's so strange. So what happened next? What's going on? You know, they were in like a camper shell, right? They're spending the night in a camper shell.
Yes. Well, they're not in the camper shell just then. They're around the fire. They see these nine objects over the mountains that are maybe 400 yards away, that kind of distance. They form a configuration of an M. And now they're nervous, particularly Elise is nervous. Like, what's going on here? Are we in the middle of maybe some kind of military exercise that we shouldn't be seeing? Because the lights start blinking at each other, like in code, like they're communicating, flashing signals. And they start to intensify. And the next thing they know is that there are hundreds of these, literally hundreds of these craft, which to them look like just huge stars. And they start dropping from the sky. Now, whatever fears they have are, you know, their heart is in their throat because it's like an invasion. It's like an attack. These things come to the ground and start rushing towards them. So Tom runs into the camper and gets a shotgun and a Browning rifle, and he's ready to protect himself and his wife against some crazy assault that he believes is going on. And actually, this is a quote, and I'll read it to you from Tom. "When we first saw them dropping from the sky, we thought it was some kind of military maneuver, maybe for Operation Desert Storm, but it was too massive even for that. I mean, there were thousands of them falling, then rushing towards us. So I kicked out the campfire, grabbed my gun, and ran into the back of the camper with Elise. Then we sat there Indian style waiting until they came, thousands of them, thousands of pairs of tiny red eyes glowing in the dark around us." So at first, he's going to shoot at them, defend himself.
Sure.
And then Elise gets a telepathic message. You know, don't try to harm us or we will kill you. Get in the back of the camper. And so that's what they do. They go in the back of the camper and wait. And while they're waiting, two sort of monitors. So if you can imagine like a fire plug, two sort of like fire plugs that seem to be electrified with a kind of blue-white electricity stand at the lip of the of the camper's exit, you know, so they can't get out. When they try to get out, like Tom were to move forward 2 feet, these monitors would move forward 2 feet. If he tried to go any further than that, he'd get a tremendous jolt of electricity. So basically, they're trapped in this camper. The other thing that I find interesting, you know, these details really are what make this story so believable and so interesting. All the desert noise stopped. There's not a sound. And the desert at night is actually pretty noisy. And they have this smell that they're starting, like a sulfur smell or phosphorus, gets kind of heavy. And so these things are rushing towards them. They're sitting there, and they see these sort of gremlins. They have red eyes. Faces that are kind of leathery, maybe the size of a cat. They're 3 feet tall, spindly legs and arms, like gremlins is how they were described, almost like monkeys or something of that sort. So basically, these things are all over the place. They're, you know, jumping on the trees. They're on the car, and they revel, like they have this boundless energy. Their eyes are fierce and malevolent, and they pierce the night because they're red, blinding red. And so packs of them climb in the trees. Packs of them are around their camper. They can see them through their windows. If you can imagine anything more horrifying, Elise turns to Tom and says, "We're going to die." They start pinching themselves then to make sure they're awake. You know, they think maybe, you know, they've gone insane. So they're pinching one another. What do you see? Do you feel that? Are we dreaming? No, I feel it. We're not dreaming. What do you see? So they describe what they see to each other. And that about that time, when they think they're on the verge of a heart attack. And when that happens, whenever they feel like their chest tightened and their brain about to explode, this mist comes in the back of the camper. And it's maybe an anesthesia or some kind of sedative, but it calms their body down, their heartbeat and their pulse. And it's like they're being kept alive so they can be experimented on. Because
how frightening.
Now they see the spacecraft. They're frightened. Now they see the spacecraft. And this is so interesting, Betsy, because maybe you've seen Fife Symington, you know, the Phoenix Light, the governor of Arizona.
Sure.
He talks about seeing a craft that he says is the size of an aircraft carrier, you know, and absolutely mind-blowing. His word, not mine. Well, what they see, and this is, you know, before any of that, he says the spacecraft, they say, was huge. It was descending from out of a dense cloud. The object literally capped the valley, then stopped, hovering about 100 yards above the desert. The craft was larger than anything they ever imagined could fly, more than a football field in diameter, and shaped like a disc, with an elevated dome that rose up from the center. And it was encircled by white lights that were flashing, again, in sort of a coordinated, coded rhythm. Beneath that were six smaller craft, maybe the size of helicopters, but in a disc formation. They were sort of hanging for the mothership's underbelly. So while they're there, they see a tunnel of light that comes down from the mothership and starts sort of combing the desert and beaming objects up and down from the craft. And they describe it like cactus, plants, cattle, trees, but sort of like patterns of things, not physical objects. And so obviously they think this is strange. And then what they see, and this is significant, I think, is a triangular craft. How many times have you heard about triangular crafts, right?
A lot.
And it's composed of red, amber, and white light, and begins to comb the desert floor as if it's searching for something, thoughtically searching. And then they feel the truck vibrate. There's a deep rumbling sound. And deep inside the ground, like the triangle is like a drill, a huge drill of some kind, and they're conducting some kind of mining operation because the smell now of phosphorus, sulfur, like burning rubber, becomes very thick. Mm. Tom and Elise begin praying. They pray for their lives. They pray for their children, and they think they're in hell. They think they've died and are in hell and being tortured. It's then that, while they're praying, that through the windows, peering into the camper windows, are what they call the illuminated figures. This would be the third type of being, totally illuminated, white light. They arrive in a group of nine circling the camper, staring in the windows of its shell like spectators observing animals in a zoo. They're taller than the others. They're about 5 feet in height with enormous raven black eyes and long spindly appendages connected to an underdeveloped torso the size of maybe, you know, a four-year-old would have. The overriding impression they have at this point is these are like scientists because they're intensely studying everything about them. And I guess if you try to put yourself in their position, can you imagine, like, this regular married couple with a couple kids, you know, are trying to get away for a weekend, and they're thrown into, you know, this cauldron of insanity. So
Ron, let me ask you this.
Yeah, please. Yeah, certainly.
Well, when you're describing the angel raven eyes, is that more of a gray and they're illuminated, or are they totally different than any species of ET that we've heard about?
I think that they're different. I mean, they describe them really as literally illuminated, like luminous.
Mm-hmm.
And they have characteristics, a body, you know, they're physical, radiate light. So I wouldn't say they're like the grays, except for the eyes and maybe the description of the body.
Right.
And maybe, who knows, maybe it is mm-hmm. an aspect of the grays that's not been seen very often.
Isn't that something that, you know, I've never heard of any of these type of ETs, and that's really unusual. But another thing I wanted to ask you, too, now the Mojave Desert has all kinds of military out there. How come they didn't respond?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to see an aircraft carrier UFO mothership up there and not respond with helicopters and everything else. I mean, were they asleep at the wheel, or what are they doing?
I don't really know. They said it came in a dense cloud. And, you know, there have
been
a lot of UFO reports, some of which are tracked on radar and some of which aren't. As a matter of fact, if you look at this Navy, these Navy pilots that in 2004, 2002 got, you know, videotape of UFOs, they couldn't get that videotape. It wasn't on radar, and they couldn't get pictures of it until their radar was recalibrated. So in other words, these things had been around a long time, and the U.S. Navy didn't detect them, and they were, you know, bouncing around above aircraft carriers, you know, our technologically advanced aircraft carriers.
Sure.
And it was almost by mistake that they ever got picked up, because they were fooling with the radar and trying to make it more sensitive to slower moving and smaller craft. And that's how they started seeing these UFOs, which were not, you know, were not on their radar screen prior to that. So is it odd? It's odd, but I you know, it's not unheard of. And who knows? Now you hear Mark Rubio, who's a senator, come out and say, along with John Radcliffe, who's the former Intel director of the United States of America, right? That these alien reports have been coming in for years, that people have been coming to them, whistleblowers, and talking about UFOs and talking about threats to our airspace, because they're so advanced, the speeds and the maneuveral, the capabilities that they have in terms of maneuvering. But this was under wraps until, you know, a whistleblower came out with leaked the videos. But this was a well-known thing, apparently, for years, many years. So it's really odd. Maybe they did know about it. How about that?
Yeah, well, I think so. There's been a huge cover-up since Roswell, you know, and the crash there, and even beyond that, I'm sure. So we're just hearing some bits and pieces of it now. They're teasing us with all the information, and who knows if they'll ever come out with, the total documents that aren't redacted, you know, blacked out totally. So, but I wonder if these aliens, you know, people see them go in and out. I mean, they're there 1 minute, like Skinwalker Ranch, what's going on there. They'll see this orb, and then all of a sudden it disappears, and they think there's a portal there. So I think they're using portals to go in and out, and maybe that's why our military isn't seeing them sometimes. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's very possible. As a matter of fact, I've heard some people discuss that maybe they're time travelers.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe, you know, there are portals, and if you think about physics, you know, you talk about something not being able to go to the speed of light, because that's you're doing it on a straight line, and if you do something on a straight line, that distance is going to be tremendous. But if you were to fold that. If you were to fold it and have a portal, that kind of travel, which would take, you know, maybe 100 light years, could probably be accomplished very readily. through wormholes and things of that nature, which we're not
sure.
very familiar with.
No.
So, you know, as a matter of fact, Betsy, there's this John Radcliffe, again, this is the director of intelligence for the United States of America, former. He said this. He said the government had 80 observed multiple sensors that described UFOs as objects that interrupted pre-planned military training and other military operations. They appear to demonstrate advanced technology. In 18 incidents described in 21 reports, observers reported unusual UAP patterns of flight characteristics. He says, these technologies we don't have and are not capable of defending against. That's the guy that's in charge of national security.
Yeah.
I think that's
pretty
amazing.
You better believe this. It is amazing. Totally amazing. And how far are they advanced? I mean, is it thousands of years, millions of years? We just don't know.
No, I have no idea. No idea. But for them, it just seems almost irrefutable at this point. As a matter of fact, this is what Marco Rubio said. So this isn't just not some lightweight. This is a guy that's been senator, ran for president, and probably will again. He said, we have two options here. We have people at the highest level of our government with the highest level of security clearances possible who say they've seen these things. There's two possibilities. Either they're telling the truth and they're real, or we have people that are crazy running our intelligence agencies. I mean, you can't not believe people at that level. Or if so, there's so many of them, you would have an incredible number of crazy people in incredibly high places in government, which doesn't make much sense.
You know, when I was a little kid, I used to tell people there were aliens. You know, it says in the Bible and everything, and people just thought I was nuts. You know, this kid's nuts. I don't think they're laughing so much anymore.
No, I think you're being vindicated by the day.
Yeah, thank you. I think so too.
So you know, Betsy, there's another element of this that I'd like to get into, which is what happened to them while they're in the camper.
Yes, please do.
So basically,
and talk about the angels.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
Which I think is, again, an incredible element of the story. So
mm-hmm.
I won't dwell on this, but they're actually tortured while they're in the camper by these illuminated figures. They're made to have flashes of memories, but it's not like they're memories. It's like they're living it again. And some of them are good memories, like Tom playing football at the University of Redlands. Unwrapping Christmas presents. But then there are others that are absolutely horrifying, where he's hunting in the high desert with his pals, but then he becomes the hunted, and they're chasing him down, and they actually shoot and skin him. So, you know, there are these terrifying things. As far as Elise, you know, nice memories with her dad listening to classical music, you know, in church singing with her mother, you know, a birthday cake when she's 6 years old. But then there's more horrifying things, like she remembers the birth of her second child. And now in that living it, she is not allowed to see the child after it's born. She insists on it and fights her way in to an area. They're hovering over the baby. But when they turn around, they're aliens that are hovering around the baby, which I guess to a young mother would be absolutely horrifying. She relives, I'd mentioned there was an assault, and she relives that. So some of the memories, basically it's this. It's like these illuminated figures are getting into the mind of these two, this man and this woman. How do emotions work? How does fear work? How does love work? How does joy work? You know, how does anger work? And so these are experiments. And interestingly enough, in that area of the desert, petroglyphs. But there also
yes.
there is a ground drawing that can only be seen by plane. That's the Mojave Twins.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
they look exactly like the illuminated figures.
Oh, wow. Isn't that something?
And
no
that
coincidence
was,
there.
And that was created maybe 500-600 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
at this point, you had mentioned the angel. And this I find interesting because it almost puts a religious flavor to it or something along those lines, because the next thing they see when they're absolutely, contemplating just getting it over with. I mean, how do we get out of this? Maybe we're dead already. Maybe we need to be dead. Maybe whatever we can do, they're at the end of their rope. They see a kind of cloud that turns into an angelic figure. They called it the Comforter, their Comforter. It's a beautiful sort of vision. And if you imagine an angel, just the angel that you would think of when you see that, except, huge. And they get this telepathic message, don't worry, you will survive this. Your children will be all right. You will get through this. Pretty much not too far after that, they feel they see the circular probe of light from the mothership come over their truck, and the last thing they remember is being lifted, the truck and all of the surroundings, into the mothership. They have very muddled memories after that, and we retrogress them to find those memories. But the next morning when they awaken, they're out of the camper. And they're around the fire, which has died out and is dead. And they think that something monumental has happened, that Earth has been invaded by aliens or there's been a Russian invasion. This is so massive. So they go to the radio and there's nothing about it. They see another camper later and they ask, did you see anything strange? Absolutely nothing. And so they're left with this horrible hangover of terror that's sort of in their gut, and no one else can imagine it. No one else has experienced it, and it must be an incredibly lonely, experience. You must feel marooned outside
sure.
of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so
sure.
They had some experience then afterwards at their home. Their son, Tom Jr., is asleep. They're asleep in their bedroom. They hear noise in Tom Jr.'s bedroom. They open the door, and he's spinning like a top.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they grab him. They grab him, and he goes, what's happened? What's wrong? He goes, it's the monsters. They're monsters, The mother says, there are no monsters. It's your imagination. He goes, no, there are. They're little, and they have red eyes.
Isn't that something?
Just terrifying.
And, children are targeted, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just, I know other stories that are like that. And I just had somebody on the show, Marisol Smiley,
uh-huh.
who talked about her children seeing these orbs and are frightened. They're so frightened of these things. So, children see these things. Really weird.
Yeah, and another, actually, they're in bed making love, and they look around, and these aliens are over their bed, hovering over their bed, watching them. And Tom goes to Elise, you're pregnant. And she goes, how would you know that? What are you talking about? She goes, I don't know how I know it, but I know. And sure enough, she was pregnant. So that kind of thing, just in your life, just intimately in your, in your head, in your existence.
Didn't she say on an interview on the Sci-Fi Channel that she thought that her child was going to have alien DNA?
Yeah. She did say that. I don't think that's the case. I don't think
you
that's
don't
the
think
case.
So?
And really, they're
no.
very reluctant to talk about their children. You know, very reluctant to talk about their children. I know that.
Yeah.
With good reason,
well,
I suppose, you know.
Oh, sure. Let's go into the hypnosis, because some of the things that Elise said were just mind-blowing. So let's talk about that. That blows my mind every time
sure.
I look at it.
Well, I'll read from the transcript, which is probably better than me summarizing.
Okay, sure.
Bear with me. They're retrogressed. So they're hypnotized and they're asked to go back in time to that time in October. So the doctor says, you know, why are they here? Why do they want to make contact? And this is Elise, to deliver a message that the world needs to be as one, that if there's a war or massive destruction, they will intervene. What else do you know? So I was in the room and watching Elise just sprang up in her chair, all of a sudden animated and alert. Her voice, instead of being like soft and emotional, took on this cadence, like this clipped cadence that was direct and really not like her at all. And she says, they want to make contact with the population. Tom and I are specimens, imperfect like the human race. When we're ready to communicate with them face to face, then possibly the world will be too. Her actions, such as edging forward in her chair at the moment, seemed mechanical, and as did her voice as she continued. They have to study our reactions so they know how to approach us. They don't have emotions like ours, so they need us to teach them. They need to understand humans. The doctor then says, do you have a sense as to who they are and where they've come from? She answers, there are five galaxies. Theirs is the next closest. In order for all five galaxies to work together one day, they have to start, and they're starting with us, so we'll be united galaxies. What else do you know? The doctor asks, feeling as if he was in contact with someone other than Elise. I know where the universe ends, she said, rattling the words off in staccato fashion. Is that something you can put into words? Now there was like no denying. Something incredible was happening, and she speaks. Our universe ends where theirs begins. Our universe ends when all its matter stops mattering to us and starts mattering to them. Of course, everyone
Whoa.
In the room is stunned. They're stunned
Sure.
by the way she says it. But if you look at the play on words, it's really pretty interesting. Our universe
Yeah.
ends where theirs begins.
Yours begins.
Our universe Yeah. ends when all its matter stops mattering to us and starts mattering to them. What a convoluted and ominous sort of phrase,
Yeah.
is, you know?
It is. She talked about the one supreme, that these beings were sent
yes, she did.
On a mission. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Here you go. I have it. Bear with me. He goes, if these beings are in contact with you, tell me what you know about them. She says, and this is again where it gets, I don't know, like religious or the way people interpret this and religion forms around it. Or maybe it's just the way it is. This is what she answers. God created our world in his image, but not theirs or any of the others. Are there many different kinds of beings? Yes, different ones, different hybrids. When do you think this communication will happen between the aliens and humans? I don't know. In my lifetime, how long will you live? The hairs on the back of my neck raised. In a normal man's lifetime, in our children's lifetime, she said. It was then you have the distinct feeling you're like in a chess match of words. You know, she began to take satisfaction in being clever and sharp in her responses. So the doctor tries a new tack. Are we watched as a population regularly? Yes, by many different kinds of beings. Sent on missions from the one supreme. What does that mean? There's one supreme being that controls all of them. He sends missions here. They're not here of their own accord. This is like a president or like a god, she responded, really direct. What else do you know about the One Supreme? The beings could care less if they were here or not, she said. They're just following orders. Where did I take this from here, I was wondering. And I say, you talked about the universe and matter earlier. You said, our universe ends where theirs begins, and she finishes the sentence. Our universe ends when its matter stops mattering to us and starts mattering to them. What does that mean? I don't know. The missions these aliens are on, are they friendly or unfriendly? They're neutral. What does the One Supreme want, I asked pointedly, for all the galaxies to live harmoniously together? Do we have a separate God from the One Supreme? No. What else do you know about this entity? Read the Bible, she answers.
Yeah. Wow.
Pretty wild, huh?
Yeah, it is wild. Yeah.
I don't know anything like it. I don't know anything like it.
No, nothing like that. And she said that they're into everything. You know, movies like E.T., Close Encounters,
yes,
Star Trek. And
yeah,
so they watch everything that we're doing, right?
Exactly. And the thing that the point she was making there, so thanks for bringing it up, is that we're being desensitized. And actually, when I quote John Radcliffe or, you know, some of these, Marco Rubio, to her, this is all part of a desensitization so that we become comfortable with the idea of aliens existing and being in our lives. And it's the preload to contact.
Well,
so,
Ron,
so in a way, if you think about it this way, if I'm old enough to remember, let's say the 1960s, a senator, a major senator, came out with that statement, if the director of United States intelligence came out with the statements he's made, if guys like this David Grush, publicly, you know, claim the U.S. government maintains a highly secretive UFO program, and a Josh Hawley agrees. These are the people that run our country, and they're telling you there are aliens. They make contact. They're much more advanced technologically than we are. They visit us regularly. They're interested in our military. They're interested in our nuclear reactors. And congressmen are literally telling you this, and there's no reaction. We're more interested in, you know, the Cardassians or, you know, it's really quite amazing. In any other time, these officials at these high level presidents think, like even Obama made a statement about it that was pretty stunning, but they're saying we don't know what they are. They seem to possess technology that we don't, and they left it at that. But, I mean, if you can imagine, let's say, I don't know, John Kennedy saying that. If you could imagine, I don't know, Richard Nixon saying that, I think people would go crazy. But now people don't even bat an eyelash.
Right.
We are desensitized. You know, we are desensitized.
Do you think that there's undersea bases and underground, deep underground bases? I mean, a lot of people believe that or claim they've seen it. And, of course, the Nimitz, you know, different things like that. These UFOs keep diving in the ocean at incredible speeds.
Yes, the tic-tac. The tic-tac.
Yeah, the tic-tac,
you know,
right.
The footage. You have a commander of, what's the Tom Cruise movie? Top Gun. The Top Gun commander saying, I chased down a UFO. It did incredible things. It dropped 80,000 feet in 3 seconds, then went underwater and came out again and disappeared. I mean, these aren't crazy people. But
no.
Do I think there's underground bases? I don't know. I think you had it hit the nail on the head with this idea of portals.
Yes.
Because people do say they vanish. Just they're there and they're gone. Now, either that's a function of speed, or literally they disappear into another dimension, another space. Don't know. But that, I would think that's more credible.
Do you watch Skinwalker Ranch every Tuesday? Have you watched the new season?
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you see where Dr.
I've watched some of it.
Do you? Okay. Did you see the one last Tuesday?
No.
This past Tuesday?
No, I didn't.
Well, Travis Taylor claims that the experiments they're doing, because they lost time during some of these experiments, that he said transversible wormhole that is there, and they go into this big black hole showed up on the LIDAR scanner, and they were blown away. They're going, what the heck is this thing on here? There's a hole here. So, yeah, they keep going in and disappearing, and, you know, they shoot up rockets, and all of a sudden there's an orb up there, and then it vanishes, and, you know, so there's a lot of weird things, and that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, I think somebody summed it up well. We have credible people telling us relatively incredible things.
Yeah.
I think that summarizes it pretty well.
It does, absolutely. Well, Ron, you've got a new novel coming out this next year called The Unwelcome. Tell us about that. I mean, I'm excited about it, and it's based on a true story.
I am too. Yeah, it is. It's based on a true story. And a mutual friend of ours, William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist,
yes.
I got to know him when I was in college, and he was very kind to me, you know, and that's not always the case with young writers and established writers, but he was very nice and you know, wanted to help me, and he gave me this story. It's about Christine Fowler, and Clara Fowler, I'm sorry, and it's about a woman from Radcliffe, about 22 years old, who is displaying all the classic symptoms of demonic possession. She has lost time. She speaks in languages like Aramaic, you know, that she couldn't possibly know. She has a sense of clairvoyance, telling people what's going to happen to them before it happens, people that she doesn't even know. She has this lost time, but during the lost time, and this is what, again, makes this one of the most incredible psychological studies ever. During the lost time, she becomes the demon, and the demon hates her. So basically, you have what the doctor calls the saint, who is this mild-mannered student who's, you know, religious, who's, you know, soft-spoken, who is a good student, a good stenographer, holds a job down. And then you have what they call the demon. And the demon speaks in these different tongues. Her face actually remolds in front of them. You know, it's blasphemous, goes crazy in the presence of sacred objects or priests. And it hates the saint. It wants to destroy the saint. And in so doing, tries to destroy the body. And so the saint, Clara, wakes up sometimes with her furniture stacked up, you know, feet high, naked, on top of it. And she's paralyzed there for the night. She has visions of people surrounding her bed in robed figures, demons, you know, on her bedpost. Horrible nightmares. When she tries to eat, her food becomes rancid. And, you know, maggots come out of it so that she can't eat. And the reason is the demon has figured out that the weaker she is, the weaker the body is, it's the easier it is for the demon to take over the body. And so literally the demonic presence writes her notes and says, how much longer do you think you can go on like this? Why don't you buy a gun and put a bullet in your head? And then I will live forever. Yeah. So the psychiatrist says things like, you know, why do you hate her? He goes, I hate her because she's holy. I hate her. And people ask, like, why would a demon possess a human being? You know, what's the point of that? And this book answers that question in spades. And interestingly enough, there's murder involved in a detective because Clara's baby brother and sister died, each of them as babies at 4 days old, under suspicious circumstances. The father was a drunk, a wife beater, and, you know, a violent person. And so the detective wants to prove that he's guilty of these murders, and Clara would be the only one that was an eyewitness to the murders. So it involves, again, murders that actually wind up being connected to Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes. As a matter of fact, Jack the Ripper writes the detective and, you know, and wishes him luck in capturing the devil. And they actually have that letter in Fall River in a museum. So this is, if I were to put a quick summary, it's like this. Basically, Marshal Rufus Bassett Hilliard had investigated the Lizzie Borden murders. Never had come across a case so mind-bending as the murders of Charles and Bessie Fowler. All the evidence pointed to the father, John Fowler, a violent drunk and wife beater, with his daughter, Clara, the only eyewitness. Truly for Bassett, the case had become an obsession. Years later, when arrived with fresh evidence to Boston to solicit Clara's help, he finds that she's under the care of renowned psychotherapist Dr. Morton Prince and a team of notables, including Harvard professor William James, psychic researcher Richard Hogson, and a clairvoyant who was the most popular, famous clairvoyant at the time, Leonora Piper. What did it all mean? And how did each of these murders link with the serial killings of Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes? The answer the grizzled lawman discovers is more shocking than he could ever imagine. And so all of this is documented. I have the psychiatric session, which the doctor kept in the Harvard Medical School Library, where Bill Blatty had directed me. And believe it or not, I got this story from him in 1973 or so, while I was a student at Georgetown, and he was filming The Exorcist, so probably it was 72. And,
Didn't you bug him a lot to get it?
I'm sorry?
Were you pretty persistent to get that story?
Yes. I was very persistent.
Yes,
you know, everybody
you were.
Had a manuscript. I went to see his secretary, you know, begging him as I'm a kid to read my first novel. And she turns around and looks at a stack of manuscripts about 6 feet high. And she goes, I'll put it in the pile. Because he was getting manuscripts from people in Germany, France, you know, Saudi Arabia, all over the world. And and finally, I begged this poor secretary so convincingly. She said, look, I don't want to get in trouble, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll tell them that a student from Georgetown, your name, came to see me and gave me this manuscript and asked to pass it along. And then I said, but you have to tell him that I'm just like him. He was a student at Georgetown and wanted to be a writer desperately. And I'm a student at Georgetown and I want to be a writer desperately. And so I guess that did the trick, because I was on a Thanksgiving break at my parents' house, and I got a call from Bill Blatty saying, why don't you come to the Marriott? I have an office there. I want to discuss your novel. Isn't that something?
That's amazing. That's so cool. What a great story.
Yeah.
I love it.
But what a story.
My uncle, my step-uncle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah.
Well, Ron, we've run out of time.
I'm excited about the new one, and I'm excited about Mojave.
Well, I think it's going to be another bestseller. I think it's going to be a great book. I can't wait for it to come out. And do you want to give everybody your information, how to contact you and your website and all?
Sure. Yeah, it's an easy website. It's Ron Felber, R-O-N-F-E-L-B-E-R, and .com, ronfelber.com. And, of course, the Mojave Incident is available, you know, on Barnes & Noble or Amazon or, you know, any of the online bookstores, but also in the brick-and-mortar bookstores, if you ask for it.
Oh, great. Well, what a great interview, Ron. It's great talking to you again. I mean,
it's
been a
fun,
while,
but
thank
always
you
fun.
So much. And it'll get you back when The Unwelcomed comes back, so when it's out, anyway. So thank you, and wishing you a great weekend, and everybody else out there, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Take care, Ron. We'll stay in touch.
Okay, Betsy. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.